Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.
So I figured I'd start slow, maybe 20 laps, just to get the juices flowing, and then I'd start lifting weights.
The damage from the car looked like I could have killed that woman again.
There was a little playground, and literally it had a pool about the size of this stage.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WIPR. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Hinken.
Today's theme, Summer Escapades. Over the next hour, six local storytellers will share daring tales set in the steamy heat of summer's past.
Up first, here's Cherie Booker with a warning about the dangers of grabbing lunch from a drive-thru. Take a listen.
My first summer job was at a funeral home. And it started off as a summer job, and it ended off being a permanent job, and I ended up staying there for 9 years, hence the title, 9 Years Under. But it was the summer of 2002. It was my fifth summer on the job, and summer is usually our busiest time of year. I mean, with Baltimore's homicide rate and the heat strokes, I mean, We were pretty busy. In fact, we were so busy that my boss was going to give me a new task. I had mastered pretty much everything else, and today he needed me to make a removal, which meant that I needed to go pick up a body. Now, I had never driven any of the company vehicles, and that particular day, I was going to drive, not a hearse, but our removal van, which was a minivan. It was a Windstar. The back seats had been removed and they put a track in it so that you could easily slide the gurney in, flowers, anything that could just lay there. Well, back then, I was the same height. I was about 20 pounds lighter than this. So my boss sent his cousin along with me to help me out. I mean, he was like in his late 50s, 60-year-old man. I didn't know how he could assist me, but he sent him anyway. So we had to prep to go and make this removal. So basically, we washed out the gurney, the stretcher, made sure it was nice and prepared for the next person who would be riding in it. And we got ready, we got in the car, and we were on our way to the other funeral home to pick up this woman. We get there, everything's fine. In fact, our rival funeral home nicely handed over the body, even though the family decided not to use them. They were so sweet, they didn't make me lift a finger. Billy did everything. So we roll this woman out, put her in the back of the van, and everything's fine. We're on our way back to the funeral home. When one of my coworkers calls and asks if I could stop at McDonald's to get her a big and tasty meal. Now, I mean, I was in college. I was, you know, 18, 19. I didn't know it was untasteful to take someone's loved one through the drive-thru at McDonald's. And I mean, the woman who was asking my coworker, she was my superior, so I kind of had to do what she said. So it's midday, I get to McDonald's. The line is long, it's so long that Cousin Billy gets out of the car to go to the filling station to get some cigarettes. That's how long the line is. So he leaves me alone with Miss Ruffin. I, you know, get a chance to bond with her. I say a little prayer, you know, Lord, protect her, let her be okay. Bless her family. I hope they spend a lot of money. I hope I get this bonus. You know, I got some things to do this summer. I don't know what kind of casket she's gonna go on. I hope it's not a cremation. Yeah. So clearly, I wasn't paying attention when I turned the corner and crashed into the guardrail. But Ms. Ruffin, she seemed okay. I looked, she was all right. And so then I backed the van up and I make that little dent bigger. It's like ginormous, it's huge. So I'm like, okay. So I look at Ms. Ruffin again and she seems to be fine. So I'm like, okay, Ms. Ruffin, it's fine. We're in this together, okay? It's me and you. This is you and I, okay? You didn't see anything, I didn't see anything, there's no other cars involved, we're fine. So, I mean, it was so bad that the two cashiers at window one and window two, they both looked out like, okay, what's going on? So I rode up to window two, I paid the woman, I got the big and tasty meal, and I waited for Billy to come back. He comes back, he looks at it, he shakes his head, he lights his cigarette, he smokes about 10 of them at one time. I call my boss and let him know that I've crashed. I start thinking that I need to pack my things because this is probably my last day at work. So I get back to the funeral home, pull the car into the garage. I go upstairs, take this woman her big and tasty meal. It's here, all right? So my boss, in the meantime, he's inspecting the car. He sees the damage. He needs to check Miss Ruffin to make sure Miss Ruffin is okay. About 2.5 minutes later, he summons me to the basement. Booker, get down here now. So I'm just like picking up my shoes from under the desk, taking everything, making sure I don't have any paychecks left there. I'm just taking everything. I get downstairs. Where are Miss Ruffin's legs? Well, I think they're on her body. They should be there. He's not joking. He's not laughing. So I'm sitting there like, okay, did I just commit vehicular manslaughter or something? What has happened to Miss Ruffin's legs? Well, I never checked the bag before I left. And Miss Ruffin happened to be a paraplegic, so she really didn't have any legs. But my boss didn't know. The damage from the car looked like I could have killed that woman again. So, there's a moral to this story, which would be, one, you should probably check the bag when you're making a removal, make sure everything's in there. And two, you should never, ever, ever, ever drive a dead body through the McDonald's on Franklin Town and Warwick Avenue. Thanks.
That was Cherie Booker. You can find this incredible story and more in her memoir, 9 Years Under, Coming of Age in an Inner City Funeral Home.
Up next, we set sail with Meredith Hadaway.
So I come to you today from the Chester River, which is the upper shore, and I was invited to tell a tale of the tide, so, you know, here's mine. So I got my first boat in 1988. I got a little tipsy at a Labor Day picnic and decided to buy a 13-foot aluminum runabout with a 30-horsepower Johnson motor. I didn't know anything about boating, nothing. In those days, there was no Coast Guard requirement that you take a course, which, by the way, I highly recommend, but they didn't require it back then. I learned everything I know about boating by trial and error, and I have to say mostly by error. So I learned, how to pour Coca-Cola on the battery terminals when the boat wouldn't start. I learned how to disengage a crab pot from my propeller. I learned how to get out and push when my boat ran aground, and because I live upriver of the Chester River Bridge where the water's not very deep, that happened a lot. And I also learned that the gas gauge on a boat never works. And not only does it never work, the needle is always stuck at 3/4 of a tank. Like, why couldn't it be stuck on zero? You know, that would be fair. But it took me the longest time to figure out that, no, I did not have any gas. And so I discovered the joy of drifting. And to drift on the Chester is to just turn off the motor, raise it, and let the river take you where the river wants you to go. It's just a great way to discover things that you didn't know that you needed to discover. And I had the experience of meeting shoulder to shoulder with a mama osprey who was sitting on a nest on a channel marker. I had the experience of discovering hidden duck blinds with a whole litter of liquor bottles around them. I, at one point, floated over a whole rock pile that you could never do with your prop down and saw that it was teeming with fish of all sizes, all kinds, because fish love rocks. Who knew? I also was floating by a ledge that had fossils, and it was a prehistoric panorama of ancient sea critters who actually, before there was a river, when there was no bank, that's when they were hanging out there. So it's amazing the things that you can find on any river if you don't have a destination. So that seemed to be important for me, and I took that to heart and spent a lot of time drifting. One of the things, though, that you will discover when you don't have forward momentum is that the tide that's rising so gracefully around your boat might also, as in my case, be rising inside your boat. One thing I didn't know about aluminum boats is that rivets can leak. So then, again, with no motor to interfere, you can actually hear your own heartbeat as you're wondering if anyone will happen by with some gas or to give you a tow before you completely submerge. So that was the end of my first boat, which had been named because I was, at that time in my life, suddenly single. That boat was called the No Boys Allowed. So from there, I moved to the No Boys Allowed 2 and the No Boys Allowed 3. And I had a tradition of boating with two women friends. Chris and Lisa used to reach out and say, I need a boat ride. We need a trip. So we would load up a cooler and some snacks and get on the No Boys Allowed 2 or 3, as the case may be. And we would roar down the river for like 3 or 4 miles under full power. And we got to a really wide open spot in the river. We would cut the motor. And we called that place International Waters. And the idea of being on international waters was that we were completely free of any of the constraints of our land lives, and therefore we could tell each other things that needed to be said without any kind of judgment, without any fear that whatever happened on international waters would leave international waters. So we did a lot of complaining. We did some crying, and we did a lot of laughing. And on this particular night that I remember so well, it was an absolutely gorgeous night with that beautiful last light that was making the champagne that we were drinking sparkle. And I noticed that it was sparkling with the exact same colors of my friend Chris's blonde hair. And we opened another bottle of champagne. And we were drifting, but I noticed we were still somewhere in the channel, so I wasn't too worried about that. And we just got to laughing and talking and snacking and sipping champagne. And a couple of hours went by before we looked up and realized that we were back at the Chester River Bridge. We didn't know how we got there. We weren't aware of it. We were floating right under that bridge. And lo and behold, we're practically hand-delivered back to the very dock we had left a couple of hours earlier. Was it the tide, the winds, the current? We decided it was River Angels. And so we had been safely carried back home at the end of a beautiful night without a drop of gas wasted, and we've never forgotten that night. What we didn't know about that night is that it would be Chris's last boat ride. A couple of months later, way too young, she left this world, taking her sparkle with her. And those River Angels, I've never been able to forget that hopefully they took her wherever she needed to go next. Many years passed after that. And at this point, another friend of mine, this time a guy who was an expert sailor, he was a sailboat racer, world class, he knew everything about the wind and the tide and the currents that I didn't know. But he too was leaving the world too soon. And I wanted to say a prayer for him, but I wasn't sure which God would be appropriate. And all I could think about was this river that seemed to serve, the expert boater, the sailor, the drifter, the drinker, the poet. And I started to write a poem. And the experience of writing a poem that comes to you like out of the blue, all of a piece, like it wrote itself, was so unusual to me. I never changed a word. I just thought it was another gift from the River Angels. So I want to read that poem now. Why the river? Because it is a body. Because it rises in our sweat, marries our breath to the cold. Because it spills light back to us and hoards our shadows. Because it leaves when gravity insists, but it always comes back. Because it traps the clouds so we can sail across both heaven and earth. Because it carries our tears, swells with our salt. Because it is a body. Because it bears our weight. Thank you.
That was a story from Meredith Hadaway that she shared at the Maryland Folk Festival in Salisbury, Maryland. Meredith is the poet in residence at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. The Stoop will be at the Maryland Folk Festival again this September in Salisbury, and our theme for that show is Keepers of Culture, stories about people who inspire and enlighten.
I'm Laura Wexler. You're listening to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WYPR. When we're back...
I love my recliner.
A father vows to get in shape.
Welcome back to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WYPR. I'm Jessica Henkin.
And I'm Laura Wexler. Today's theme is summer escapades.
Let's listen to this story from Elliot Wagenheim about how the great outdoors brought him and his son together.
So several years ago, my then 15-year-old son told me that he wanted to go to Philmont. Now, Philmont, for the uninitiated, is one of four high-adventure Boy Scout camps in the country. It involves a two-week trek, for us anyway, a two-week trek, 110 miles over the mountains and mesas of the northern New Mexico desert, carrying a 50-pound pack. I know. Well, I'm not going to tell you anything you don't already know just from sitting there, but I love my recliner. And indoor plumbing, don't even get me started on indoor plumbing. I love indoor plumbing. But here's the thing, and there's really no getting around this. When your 15-year-old tells you that he wants to spend 2 weeks with you, you walk through walls. So, I got up from my recliner. And I went to the gym. Now, I was a competitive swimmer in high school. I'm sure you could tell that. So I figured I'd start slow, maybe 20 laps, just to get the juices flowing, and then I'd start lifting weights. So I went in, I did 2 laps. And I was clinging to the side of the pool like a 3-year-old in a storm, and only a force of will stopped me, because I knew I couldn't spend less time in the pool than it took me to get dressed for the pool. So I gutted out 6 more laps and then took the walk of shame back to the locker room. But I went back. I went back the next day and the next day, and I'd got up to 20 laps and 40 laps. And then 3 months later, I got up to 100 laps. And then I cut it back to 50, started with a personal trainer. Now, here's the thing about Philmont. Philmont isn't just the mountains and mesas, and it's not just carrying the 50-pound pack, but in the middle of Philmont, there's a mountain, which seems to be the theme of the evening. There's a mountain, and it's 12,441 feet. Now, I would like to tell you that that mountain is called something cool, like Widowmaker, or Dawson's Revenge, but it's not. It's called Mount Baldy. So named because that's what it looks like when you get above the tree line. And all I wanted to do was summit Mount Baldy. So in the pool, every stroke, I'm like, summit, 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 summit. All I wanted to do. So it wasn't too long. We landed in New Mexico June 19th. We're in the backcountry June 20th. Now, if you ask people, they will tell you that Philmont was beautiful. And it was. And they will tell you that it was the greatest experience of their lifetime. And it could be. And they will tell you that they had seen things that they had never seen before. And that may be true. But to me, it was brutal. So we start our ascent to Mount Baldy in the middle of this, in the middle of our trek. We're starting the ascent. Now we've got four leaders. I was one because they can't call me a scout. So they have four leaders, nine scouts. So we had two leaders up front, one leader in the middle, and then one leader in the back, and that was me. Now, I like to tell myself that being in the back was just damn good leadership. But even I don't believe that lie, because frankly, by the time we got to that point, I had given everything I had to give. It was every bit a brutal trek. And I had lost track of where my crew was because of the switchbacks. To get up this mountain, you had switchbacks up and back, up and back. And it was everything I could do to get up there. And so finally, as I get near the top and I'm past the tree line, I round a corner and I see my son. And he's just kind of leaning against an outcropping, and the dad in me is like, what's wrong? Because I realize there's no reception. You can't call 911, and even if you could get to 911, ain't nobody coming. It's the backcountry. And he said to me, nothing. I just want to summit with you. And that was my best moment as a father. And one of the best moments of my life. And I never once, not for one second, regretted leaving that recliner. Thank you.
I think that's how I often would be on hikes. I would be the Elliot Wagenheim in this story, and you would be the son.
That might be true. I like to be in the front. If you fall behind too far, then you just might get left.
You actually will get left so that you can sit on a rock in the shade.
I do remember, yeah. I remember hiking with you, Jessica Henkin.
I'm not a hiker. Sticking with our celebration of summer, here's the late, great Congressman Elijah Cummings with a story about growing up in segregated Baltimore.
My mother and father were former sharecroppers from Manning, South Carolina. They came to Baltimore right after they got married in the 1940s. Mom had a third grade education. Dad had a fourth grade education. And they could actually, my father could trace his sharecropping efforts to slavery. Same land. They were made to pick the strawberries and tobacco and plow the fields. And they were not allowed to go to school. And even if they could go to school, as they tell it, the school was like 3-4 miles away. They came to Baltimore. Mother was a domestic. Daddy was a laborer. And they would be gone all day in the summertime, and we would go to the pool. Now, I lived in South Baltimore. And anybody who knows anything about South Baltimore knows Hamburg Street Bridge. When you walk easterly over that bridge, you were where I lived. There was a little playground, and literally it had a pool about the size of this stage. It was a wading pool. It was about 2 feet deep. Back then, families had, on the average, of 5, 6, 7 kids. And the pool was so small that we literally had to wait turns to get in the pool. You're supposed to be cooled off in the wading pool, but keep in mind what I'm saying. Cement at the bottom, right? 150 kids in this little space at one time. And if you didn't make the first round, you literally got into some pretty hot water. I mean, it was hot. And then something happened. A fellow named Jim Smith, African-American man who had been in the military, had reached the rank of captain, was now a recreation leader. He said, I'm tired of this. And he told us little kids, I must have been 9 years old, this is around 1960. He said, there's a big pool about 10 or 15 blocks away, and I want you all to go into that pool. So he gathered us together, And we marched over to the pool. And we looked, and we couldn't believe it. There was an Olympic-sized pool. And imagine, see, a lot of people don't know what race does to the psyche of people. Here you are, a little kid, and you're standing in line waiting for an hour or two to get in a pool with 2 feet of water. And then you go a few blocks away and see people jumping into an Olympic-sized pool. You begin to ask yourself, what is this? What's wrong with me? And so we're sitting there saying, wait a minute. And then we look at all the people at our pool, and it was segregated. We look at the people at the Riverside pool, and it was segregated. And so Mr. Smith, he just wanted us to see what we were aiming at. And then we went back. We talked to our parents, and the next thing you know, every day we would march to the pool for several days. And I'll never forget, I have a scar on my face right now where adults, I can still see their faces. That was 50 years ago. And one of them hit me with a milk bottle. I'll never forget it. Cursing at us, calling us everything but a child of God. And then there came a woman named Juanita Jackson Mitchell from the NAACP. And she came with a whole group of people, and we marched some more and marched some more. And finally, there came a day when we integrated the pool. But the damage was done. See, as long as you're in that little world, in your little world, where you don't know there's something better, it's your little world. But when you go out and you see a world blocks away, it's a whole nother thing. And so, first of all, it has made me color everything black and white. If somebody white would do something to me, I automatically thought it was racist. And you have to literally fight in your own mind to say that it's not. There's another thing that happens that makes you wonder. There used to be a song entitled, "What Becomes of the Brokenhearted?" I think about that song every day of my life because I realize that there are so many children who went through similar experiences that I went through that were negatively affected, and they did not have perhaps the parents to talk to, or maybe they didn't have the religious background that I was blessed to have. And I'm not saying I'm anything special. Don't get me wrong. But the fact is that a parent trying to explain to a child why it is that he gets, for example, the books that have been used and torn apart from the white kids, trying to explain that is hard. What becomes of the brokenhearted? What becomes of them so often is they go through life, first of all, with low expectations. So many of them fall by the wayside. Ladies and gentlemen, some kind of way we have to teach our children to put color to the side. And I think they're doing it. When I was running around the country campaigning for President Obama, I can tell you, I was amazed. And I see auditoriums, 20,000 people. And so finally we got to College Park. And when we got to College Park, I had an opportunity to talk with the president of student government and some other students after the rally was over. I said, why'd y'all come out for this black man? Because most of them were white. They said, Congressman, you're confused. They said, we did not come out for a black man. We came out for somebody we believed in. And I was telling my daughter, my 28-year-old, she says, what do you feel real good about, Dad? I said, I can go to my grave now. I said, I can go to my grave because we have elected an African-American man to the presidency of the United States. I said, and now, you know, maybe I don't have to try to be the example or the role model. Or what. They got somebody who's made it to the top. And so all the feelings that I talked about with Riverside, those negative feelings, You know, you try to figure out, what is it that I can do to make my children realize that they should must have high expectations and that not everything is colored with race and that there are a lot of very good people of all colors who really care and want people, every single child, to grow up being all that God meant for them to be. How can I make them realize it? Barack Obama. Thank you very much.
I find that story unforgettable, and the way that he talks about being a child and realizing that an adult would do harm to him, a child, I just, that is not a summer escapade that you want to really remember, but that needs to be remembered. So I'm really glad we were able to bring that story to you.
You're listening to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WYPR. I'm Jessica Henkin. We need to take a short break. When we return,
we get back to the rock and we find all of our clues and our tails are gone. They're gone. There's nothing there.
Welcome back to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WYPR. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Henkin. Our theme today is summer escapades.
We began the hour with a story about a mishap while on the clock. Now, a company softball game gone wrong. Here's storyteller Pam White.
For many, the bicentennial summer of 1976 was all about the tall ships sailing into the inner harbor, winning Orioles baseball at Memorial Stadium, the fairs and the festivals downtown before the Rouse Pavilions were constructed. For me, the summer of 1976 was about terror. It was about surviving my summer as a law clerk at a large downtown law firm in the old Maryland National Bank building. Remember when the MN were on top of the building and they changed colors from red to blue and back to red to predict the weather? I would stare at those letters hoping to divine my future with the firm. I was a second year law student. I had never been to Baltimore before. I was clueless about how a law firm operated. This law firm had never hired a woman lawyer before. No firms in Baltimore really had. I was trying out for a team and didn't know the rules of the game. Nobody did. Instinctively, I knew some things. I knew enough not to confess that I grew up a Yankees fan in New Jersey. Or that my family had cheered the 69 Mets in the World Series to defeat the Orioles. I got lost going to the bathroom on my first day of work. I was still trying to figure out the number 8 bus down from Govan's, my unair-conditioned room, trying to find my way to downtown. It did turn out that the tests, the tryouts, occurred more outside the office than in the office. I am confident I flunked my first test, eating Maryland blue crabs, trying to suck the Old Bay seasoning off the crab legs, and discovering why the beer came in gallon containers to slap my face. I did excel at beer drinking. I should have thought twice about my attire to the firm's annual family picnic. The halter top and the short shorts didn't exactly work well in the volleyball game. I do believe that the senior partners gave me a passing grade on picnic attire, but their wives did not. The true test and the true tryout turned out to be the summer softball league. Recruiting, the big firms understood that recruiting summer clerks for their batting averages and their fielding prowess was a factor in the employment decision. My summer clerk crew was in trouble. The sole male among us didn't know how to hold a bat. I, however, grew up in New Jersey, and my brothers made sure that I was never the last one picked. I could handle the fielding. I could bat. Give me a glove. I'm in the game, even if the women were relegated to second base. August 4th, 1976 was my last week of employment before I was heading back to law school. It was the last regular league summer softball game. I was pitching batting practice while the players arrived. It becomes a kaleidoscope of sights and sounds in my memories. It was a good pitch over the plate. I heard the crack of the bat. I heard and felt the crunch of the ball in my face. I remember feeling around in the dust for my glasses and feeling my job prospects fall away in the dust. I remember the lawyers arguing around the mound about which doctor they should take me to. I remember the other woman law clerk literally taking me by the hand and depositing me in the front seat of her powder blue Volkswagen Bug, and we went off to GBMC. I did have surgery. I did figure out how to fix a busted face. I was late returning back to law school. I did have trouble trying to figure out how to pay the doctor's bills before figuring out how to pay for the bar exam. But a funny thing happened. The firm offered to pay the bar exam fees, and the firm offered me a job. I accepted the offer into the big leagues. I passed the bar exam. And I spent the next 30 years of my legal career with the same firm. I will tell you, I returned to the softball field. I became a catcher and wore a mask.
I find it so entertaining and shocking that this company had never hired a female lawyer before, and that Pam's extended tryout job interview occurred on the softball field.
And it gave her grounds really to sue them if she had wanted to.
Well, that's true. That's very good legal training.
She showed them what she was made of by not suing them.
To close out today's show, Deborah Keene shares about skinny dipping shenanigans.
Well, in 1979, I was 25 years old, and I was living in a commune in Waverly. I don't know if there's any Waverlyites here, but there we go, Waverly. In those days, Waverly was like the little Greenwich Village of Baltimore, and there were many other communal houses. The hub was Bread and Roses Coffee House, Sam's Belly Co-op, and the 31st Street Bookstore that were on 31st Street. Our communal house was at Berkwood and Barclay. It was called the Berkwood House. And it really was a very special time. We did not have a TV. We didn't even have a phone. And, of course, there was no internet. And actually what people did was many of us were artists and musicians and poets and philosophers, a lot of political activists. But what you did was you sat around and you told stories like this, and that's how you got to know people.
was by sharing your stories of your life. And it was a very sweet time. We weren't focused on making money. We didn't have to make very much money to make our lives work. And we took odd jobs. We were beloved in the neighborhood. We got child care and house painting jobs. And we also did a lot of favors for people. And it was such a spontaneous type of lifestyle. We were really focused on being in the moment, being awake and aware. And a lot of us were doing a lot of personal growth work. And it wasn't at all about doing and making money and being in the culture of upwardly mobile was like completely far away from where we were. It was a humble, sweet, beautiful time. Lots of friends in the neighborhood. Sometimes I'd come downstairs thinking I was getting a glass of water and I wouldn't make it back home for a couple days. somebody would sweep you out the door to another party and, you know, you'd be jamming and doing art and going. So it was really, really special time. One of the things we really loved to do, and on this story evolves around, it was a hot summer's day, and six of us said, hey, let's go to the reservoir. Now, we had forged our own trail at Pretty Boy to our own rock spot. And we could park our car legally and walk about a quarter of a mile along the road. And then maybe it was another mile or so through the woods to get to this spot. And we had forged the trail and found the spot, and it was really sweet. And so we spontaneously, and spontaneity, by the way, is a symptom of freedom. I'm glad you like that, yeah. These days it seems a little harder to come by for some reason. It does feel a little different now. But so we all headed off in Ethel, my 1968 Chevy Nova. And, you know, we got to the rock, and, you know, it was such a hot day. We were shedding our clothes as we climbed that last hill, and then just all running and jumping and diving in this crystal clear, just spring-fed, wonderful water. And we knew there were no rocks underneath. It was very safe. Boy, did that feel good on a hot day. I want to say something about being naked outside with really close friends. It just... I don't know y'all, so I don't know if many of you have had that pleasure. I bet some of you have, just by what I'm feeling here. It feels very natural. It's very sweet. And, you know, I would actually totally forget I was naked because it felt so natural. You would just forget. And we were all nature lovers. That was sort of our religion, really. And so there we all were, and it was a very hot day, and we decided to swim across to the opposite shoreline where there was shade. So I had my mid-sized inner tube that we all paddled over together, and we hung out over there a few hours and just had a really sweet day. And the sunset was sort of coming on, and we swam back across. We get back to the rock, and we find all of our clothes and our towels are gone. They're gone. There's nothing there. I did feel naked then. Definitely felt very naked. And so we thought that a friend was going to jump out and go, ha ha, you know, we took your clothes and here they are. But no, we were patient, you know, but no, that didn't happen. So we got a little spooked, like, well, what should we do? And it was four guys and two gals, and two of the guys, we decided no one should be alone, and two of the guys went off to look for the clothes in the woods while we waited. And they were gone a while, and when they came back, we could see they sort of had their arms like this, and we thought, oh, good, they found them. But no, what they had were bundles of very large leaves. So, we came up with a brilliant plan, and so we gathered around Timmy and we tied the stem to the leaves together, and we fashioned sort of a leaf skirt for Timmy,
And then we were sort of chagrined because there were only three leaves left. But Joey said, no, that's okay. And he demonstrated one leaf in the front and two leaves held just so on the back for each cheek. And so the plan was they would go get the car. Now, a nice detail about Ethel was that the ignition had broken in Ethel. And my mechanic said, well, for $150, I can fix the ignition. But for $20, I can hotwire your car to a button in the ashtray. And you know which option I took, right? So one of Ethel's doors were slightly smashed and the doors didn't lock. So all that was fortuitous because it meant we could start the car. Because all of our keys and everything were gone. So Timmy and Joey went on ahead, and the four of us waited a while and followed behind, and the plan was they would get the car and pull up right next to where the path came out, and we all jumped in. And then those funky floor mats just became golden, and everybody was wrestling and tug-of-warring over those floor mats because people were trying to find things to cover themselves with because, you know, now we're going back into public totally naked, six of us, right? So I felt like I was sitting pretty because I had my inner tube, which was just right, just so, you know, as I sat. So I was good to go. But one of the guys took one of the visors off, and that worked. And, you know, there was a funky old, you know, dirty oil rag, and somebody else grabbed that. And everyone was real grouchy. No one thought it was the slightest bit funny, you know. I was serious. So we get in the car and we take off, and immediately the idiot light starts dinging, and we realize, oh no, we're almost out of gas. Oh no. And then there's like a new wave of, oh no, because then we didn't even want to imagine Timmy in his leaf skirt, like, you know, walking down the road with a gas can or something, you know. So, lucky thing, in those days, there were still full station gas stations, full service, you know. And so we had to head for York Road. And we headed for York Road, and we got to the gas station, thank God. We made it in there. The strangest thing was the gas station attendant came over and was just deadpan, as if he always saw six naked people with leaves and car parts covering them, you know. He was like, how much do you want? And we realized we didn't have any money, and so then we had to dig under the seats and behind each other while we were trying to hold our coverings on, you know. And we came up with 43 cents, which in those days I bought a half gallon of gas. Gas was like 80 cents a gallon, 1979, right? So you'll be happy to know we made it home, and we scurried in one at a time, backed into the house, you know. And a little postscript is the next day Joey went back and he found all of our clothes. The keys and ID that people were worried about was still there. The few dollars we had with us was gone. And we continued to swim at that spot for the next 5 years, but I don't think we ever left our clothes unguarded. Thank you.
I know all of the listeners want to know if you, Laura Wexler, have ever been skinny dipping.
Yes. What about you, Jessica Henkin?
Yes, but like with a lot of concern.
I would not do what she did. I would not be in like a place where I knew people. I would do it in a foreign locale.
Yeah. I went skinny dipping in the bay, and that's a risk because of all the jellyfish.
That's right. But that's what makes it exciting. Next Dupe Storytelling Series show is Friday, August 16th at Manor Mill in Moncton.
Our theme is rose-colored glasses, stories of summertime nostalgia. Show starts at 7 p.m. and the musical guests are the Honey Dewdrops. Ticket information is available at stoopstorytelling.com.
Thanks to our producer, Maureen Harvey, and to you for listening. You can hear more from the Stoop Storytelling Series at our website or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jessica Henkin.
And I'm Laura Wexler. Everyone has a story. What's yours?
Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.